When we got through, we discovered there were 22 things she liked about her job. Now, I said, what I want you to do is I want you to go home tonight. I want you to take this list and get in front of the mirror just before you go to bed. And I want you to slowly read every single thing you like about your job. The last thing at night, as you plowed into your subconscious mind, I want you to think of all of the good things which are there. And tomorrow morning, just before you go to work, I want you to get the list out again, get back in front of that mirror, and slowly read all of the good things which you like about your job. And take the list with you. And take it with you every day, because you're going to now become a good finder. You're going to discover that as you analyze what you do, the company you work for, and the people you work with, that there are a lot of beautiful and positive qualities there. And the more you look for those, the more you're going to find. Do this for at least 21 days, because it takes 21 days to establish a new habit. I was back over there in Birmingham about a month later. And as I walked in, here sits the little lady right on the front door, on the front row, grinning just like she'd walked through a swinging door on somebody else's push. I mean, she was really tickled, you know. And I asked, I said, well, how you doing? She said, well, I'm still not completely out of the woods. But she said, you can't believe how much those people down there have changed. Her world changed because her attitude changed. Yours will do the same. Expect the best from yourself and others. The L in our jail formula stands for loyalty. When I talk about loyalty, I'm talking about to the company you represent. When you work for them, you simply give it everything you got, and for a very practical reason. You see, the law clearly says that if you give it your very best, it's got to give you back its very best. But I also talk about loyalty, husbands to wife. In my lifetime, I've had some of the rarest privileges anyone could conceivably imagine. I've been on the platform with our current president as well as our former president. I know personally three men who are worth well over $500 million. I've been on the platform with the superstars in television and athletics and the movie industry. I have worked with people who make literally millions of dollars a year. But for 14 years of my life, I sold person to person in the home. I have been in homes where I literally could look through the floor and see the ground underneath. I have been in homes where I could look through the ceiling and see the stars up above. I've crossed every racial, socio-economic, ethnic, religious line our society offers. And I will flat look you dead center and say to you that I've never known a happy man or a happy woman who was married who was not 100% loyal to their mate. Period. Folks, what I'm really saying is that if you want all of the good things in life, we got to have the solid foundation. Now, why do I talk so much about this? And while a lot of people would interpret as being a business course, a motivation course, very simple. There isn't an owner in this live audience today. There isn't a manager in this live audience today who won't tell you very quickly that his or her employees, whether they be male or female, are better, more productive employees if they have a happy home life. As a matter of fact, a West Germany insurance company has just completed a study in which they discovered that if the husband, when he leaves home, if he kisses his wife goodbye, I mean kisses her goodbye like his wife, not like his little sister, that his life expectancy is 5 years longer than the man who does not. So you see, fellas, your very life is at stake. Love your wife is what I'm really saying. But, you know, there's another side of that coin, too. They also discovered, girls, that your standard of living is at stake for you to love your husband, because the husband who gets the goodbye kiss every day as a wife, not as a sister now, gets that kind of a goodbye kiss, his income is over 30% more than those who do not. Now, girls, there's a new wardrobe, a new car, and there's a whole lot of other things. You see, I'm talking about a very practical foundation upon which
we're going to build.
Let's close with some wise words from Elbert Hubbard. If you work for a man, in heaven's name, work for him. If he pays you wages which supply you bread and butter, work for him. Speak well of him, stand by him, and stand by the institution he represents. If put to a pinch, an ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of cleverness. If you must vilify, condemn, and eternally disparage, resign your position. And when you're outside, damn to your heart's content. But as long as you're a part of the institution, do not condemn it. If you do that, you are loosening the tendrils that are holding you to the institution. And at the first high wind that comes along, you will be uprooted and blown away and probably will never know the reason why. Many years ago, Mark Twain said, "One learns peoples through the heart, not the eyes or the intellect." Unfortunately, as managers of people, we often feel like the speaker who was met with less than a resounding welcome and said, in the words of William Shakespeare, it's nice to be among friends, even if they are somebody else's. So many times, managers and their employees almost seem to work at developing an adversary relationship. Instead, we have to be like the small boy who was confronted by the three big bullies, any one of whom could have obliterated him. They even gave some indication they were going to do exactly that. Like a lot of us, the little guy wasn't too well qualified to fight. But like all successful managers, he was qualified to think. In this case, his physical well-being depended on it. With this in mind, the little guy backed up dramatically, drew a line in the dirt with the toe of his shoe, looked the leader of the group in the eye, and said, "Now you just step across that line." Well, as you might imagine, the big bully confidently, even arrogantly, stepped across the line. The small boy then smiled broadly and exclaimed, "Now we're both on the same side." If we're going to be successful in managing people, we've got to remember that the manager and the people he manages are on the same side. You probably recall that Sir Edmund Hillary and his native guide, Tanzing, were the first people to make the historic climb of Mount Everest in 1953. Coming down from the mountain peak, Sir Edmund suddenly lost his footing. Tanzing held the line taut and kept them both from falling by digging his axe into the ice. Later, Tanzing refused any special credit for saving Sir Edmund Hillary's life. He considered it a routine part of the job. As he put it, mountain climbers always help each other. Can we, as managers, afford to be any different? Aren't we obligated to work with our people to direct their energies and help them to develop their skills and talents to the fullest? It is my conviction that if you could take only one thought or one idea out of top performance, it would be the thought I will share with you now. If you would really be an expert in the people business that determines 85% of your success, then you should look into this statement. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care about them.
I love to play golf. I don't know how many of you folks in the audience today love to play golf. Just a matter of curiosity, how many of you like to play golf? Okay, it's my favorite game. I just love to get, I don't get to play very often. So when I do, I like to get out there and I tee that ball up so I can get at it. And like a lot of these, sometimes golfers, man, I get after that dude. I rear back and I let the string all the way out. Boom! And then if I can find it, I hit that dude again. Well, anyhow, I found out a long time ago that a fast game of golf and a slow game of golf both require about 5 hours. And when you're gone as much as I'm gone, I'm not about to go home and kiss that redhead and that boy goodbye and hit for the golf course, but I love to play golf. So several years ago, I came up with an absolutely brilliant idea, if I do say so myself. Bought my wife and my son a set of golf clubs. And everybody was excited about it, except my wife and my son. But they went along with the idea, for about 5 games. And in the 5th game, a redhead said, "Honey," said, "I just don't like to play golf. That is just too hot, or it's too cold, or it's too wet, or it's too dry, or it's too windy, or too something." Said, "Just count me out." Well, there went golf buddy number one. Into the summer, my boy said, "Dad," said, "I don't hardly know how to tell you this." He said, "I know how good you like to play golf, and I know how good you like to be with me and all. And Dad, I like to be with you too, But Dad, golf is just not my game," said, "count me out." And went golf buddy number two. Well, for the next 3 years, there wasn't much golf in my life. And then one night we'd been out to dinner and we were over on North Central Expressway. That's when the Dalrymple driving range was still over there. We'd been to dinner, as I say, and as we were riding past, all of a sudden my son spoke up and said, "Dad," said, "let's stop and hit a few." Well, my boy is a smooth talker. So we stopped to hit a few. We were banging away, and after a couple of minutes, he said, "Dad, let me borrow one of you woods." So I handed my son my four wood, and he choked up on a little bit, and he reared back, and I mean, he let the string out. He tore into that dude. He busted it right down the middle, about 40 yards further than he'd ever hit a golf ball before in his life. And when he turned around, that smile on his face clearly said, "Ziegler, you got yourself a golfing buddy now." Second most beautiful smile I've ever seen on that boy's face. Now, the most beautiful one came a couple of days later. We were out at the club playing. On one of the par fours, my boy again took that four wood, and he really poleaxed that dude this time. Had a little draw on the end of it, hit the ground, running like a scared rabbit, ended up dead center right in the middle of the fairway. Perfect position. We got down to it. My boy took his 5-iron out, and just like you see him do it on television, kept his head down. He smooth stroked that ball. It took off. It got right over the green. It landed just as soft as a feather, about 40 feet from the pin. Now he's hunting his bird. Now, if you're not a golfer, that simply means that if he sinks this putt, he's one under par for the hole. Well, I showed the boy how to line the putt. I showed him how to stroke it. And when he stroked that ball, if you're a golfer, you'll appreciate this. You knew when he stroked it, that was it. There never was any doubt about it. It was in the cup all the way. When that ball hit the bottom of that cup, that boy jumped straight up about 6 feet. And still beat me to the ground by 5 seconds, I'll tell you. You're talking about excitement. Man, there was excitement. I grabbed that boy and hugged him. We did a victory dance there for a couple of minutes, and all of a sudden it dawned on me that I had a problem. You see, I was on the green in two also. I was hunting my bird. I was only about 10 feet away. Now, I knew that if I missed the putt, the boy would figure that I had done it on purpose so he could win. That would have given him a cheap victory, which is quite a loss. Therefore, I determined that I was going to do my very best so that if I did miss it, then I could honestly look at my son and say, "Congratulations, son, you've won it fair and square." Well, my best effort always includes a little providential help, which I personally believe is perfectly legitimate, even on a golf course, maybe especially on a golf course. Well, anyhow, I lined the putt as well as I know how to line a putt. And I stroked it as well as I've ever stroked a putt in my life. And just like it had eyes, it went straight to the bottom. Before I reached down to pick the putt out of the cup, I looked at my son. And I said, "Now tell me the truth, boy. Were you pulling for Dad?" And my son looked at me, and without any hesitation, without any question at all in his mind, with considerable firmness and complete directness, said, "Dad, I always pull for you." Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's love. When you understand that my son was only 11 years old, that he had never beaten his dad a hole of golf, that it would have meant a great deal to him, and yet without hesitation, "Dad, I always pull for you." I believe personally that's what we need in every home, in every county, in every state, in this great land of ours. It's what we need between the parent and the child, between the teacher and the student, between the husbands and the wives, between the judge and those who are in front of him, between every individual in the game of life. When you're dealing with another person, we've got to look at that other individual and say, what is in the long-range best interest of that individual? See, a lot of times people want to hear certain things, and what they want to hear is not always what they need to hear. Real love says we deal with that other person on the basis of what is best for that other person. When you're trying to persuade another individual to take a specific action, if you're pulling for them to take the right action for their benefit, not yours, theirs, at that precise instant, you become infinitely more persuasive, infinitely more professional, infinitely more productive. You become infinitely more, because people don't really care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Now, sacrifice and giving part of ourselves is not a popular concept in our society today. But think with me for just a second. When you come in at the end of the day and your spouse greets you at the door, chattering like a magpie about something in which you are totally disinterested, and you stop and give him or her your undivided attention, aren't you giving your loved one a part of your life? Aren't you giving up a little bit of yourself? When you have been dealing with people, not always successfully, all day, what you really want is a few minutes of peace and quiet in front of the evening news or with a newspaper, just as you settle down your children whom you love, but want to do so from a distance for the next few minutes, come climbing on you as if you were a jungle gym. At this point, when you either turn the TV off or put the newspaper down so that you can give them your love and undivided attention, you're investing a part of your life in theirs and giving up a little bit of yourself. When you're dead tired because it's been one of those days and an employee needs an empathetic ear and counseling and you take the time to listen, aren't you giving up a part of yourself? If you would be an expert in the people business, remember, people just don't care how much you know until they know how much you care about them. Management's imperative is to cultivate its human resources. And since you're involved in top performance, obviously you realize the importance of your greatest resource, your people. Here's some suggestions from researchers which we are reinforcing and expanding throughout top performance. Show respect for a job well done. Get rid of second-class job citizenship regardless of pay differences. Real job equality is feeling we have a stake in our company's success. We must involve employees. This means providing opportunities to make decisions and give useful input. This does not mean surrendering basic decision-making powers. It does mean giving employees a chance to participate, to be involved, and to hold them accountable. As a company leader, keep skid chains on your tongue. Talking about others may be destructive and probably is just gossip unless it's specifically designed to help. Cultivate a calm, persuasive voice. How you say it is often more important than what you say. In any type of discussion or confrontation, your objective is to win them over, not win over them. Short on promises to your people and long on fulfillment. Action does speak louder than words. Be interested in the goals, welfare, homes, and families of those with whom you work. People have many facets in their lives. Don't be a one-dimensional supervisor. You may not supervise their private lives, but you can let them know you really care. Keep an open mind on all debatable questions. Being the boss doesn't necessarily mean you're always right. Discuss, but don't argue. The mark of superior minds is to be able to disagree without being disagreeable. Be careful of employees' feelings. Wit, put down, and any form of ethnic or racial digs are no-nos. Leaders instinctively know that when someone is resentful and has a chip on his shoulder, the best way to remove the chip is to let him take a bow. Since employee morale is affected by many factors in and outside the workplace, those who have confidence in management's integrity are most likely to deliver their best work and to do so consistently. The best way management can build this confidence in itself is to communicate its abilities honestly, confidently, and directly. A well-run company is the best employee morale builder available. In summary, what the researchers and their statistics say is very important. However, what they don't say is even more important. What the workforce obviously wants is management they can look up to, but management which does not look down on them. Once we have earned the trust of employees, we are in a position to motivate them. One of the early success writers suggested we take the word motivation and make a slash between the V and the A. And if you've got just a little bit of imagination, you can see two words. The word on the left is motive, and the word on the right is action. People who are motivated have a motive. They have a reason, a purpose, or a cause, and then they take action on that reason, purpose, or cause. Question, have you given it any thought at all? It is going to require motivation. Maybe not quite as much as excitement as this old boy down in Texas had. Like everybody knows, a rich Texan's richer than anybody.
Now, the reason I say everybody knows that is everybody tells me about those rich Texans. Well, anyhow, this old boy was really rich. He lived out in West Texas, had 300,000 or 400,000 acres of land. He had literally thousands of cattle. He had dozens of producing oil wells. He had a mansion with about 30 or 40 rooms in it, had an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and he had a beautiful daughter of marriageable age. Well, came time for the girl to start thinking seriously about matrimony, and old dad decided to have a coming out party. Now, in sales language, we call that group prospecting. So what he did was he mailed out an awful lot of invitation to come into a big party. Well, he had the big party. All the young men from within 50 miles of there came in, and it was a gala occasion. Long about midnight, he led them all out by the swimming pool, which he had had the foresight to stock with water moccasins and alligators. And he said to the young men, now, the first one of you guys who will jump in his pool and swim the length of it, he said, I'll give you three choices. You can have either 10,000 acres of my best land, or you can have $2 million in cash, or you can have the hand of my beautiful daughter in marriage. Now, I don't think I need to tell you this, but let me just remind you that this is our only heir, and the man who gets the hand of my daughter will eventually get all of this big spread. Well, no sooner were the words out of his mouth than there was a loud splash down at one end of the pool, followed almost immediately by the emergence of a dripping young man from the other end of the pool. He had just set a world's record which will never be approached. I mean, he really had moved through that water. Well, the host ran down to the other end of the pool. He said, son, that's absolutely fantastic. Congratulations. He said, you get your choice. He said, do you want the 10,000 acres of land? The young man said, no, sir. He said, well, then, would you like to have the $2 million in cash? And the young man said, no, sir. He said, well, then I assume that you want the hand of my daughter in marriage. And the young man said, no, sir. And the host said, well, for crying out loud, what do you want? The young man said, I want to know the name of that dude that pushed me in the swimming pool. Now, folks, that's motivation. Now, quite obviously, this young man had a reason for what he was doing. It might not be what you originally expected it to be, but he had a reason. Question, do you have a reason for what you do? Have you clearly identified your reason, purpose, cause, your motive? Are you willing to take action on that reason, purpose, or cause? An equally important question, if you're trying to motivate others, have you clearly identified their reason, purpose, or cause? Or are you trying to get them to take action on your motives? Successful people who motivate themselves and others are aware of and honestly identify their motives are those of the ones they would motivate and then take the action steps necessary for success. Good managers encourage others to take the steps necessary for their personal success. Fred Smith, one of the truly outstanding management consultants in America today, says, find the essence of each situation, like a logger clearing a log jam. The pro climbs a tall tree and locates the key log, blows it, and lets the stream do the rest. An amateur would start at the edge of the jam and move all the logs, eventually moving the key log. Both approaches work, but the essence concept saves time and effort. Almost all problems have a key log if we learn to find it. Throughout Top Performance, we have made every effort to give credit where credit is due. We have painstakingly tracked down every traceable bit of information to keep from claiming originality when there was none. In these final comments concerning the science of top performance, we want to share with you some management gems that, frankly, are difficult to credit. These are timeless truths that have really been shared by most, if not all, effective managers. Hopefully, you will find some key logs in these concepts and formulas that will answer your opportunities to solve problems more efficiently and effectively. Here's a formula for top performance management. Number one, show honest and sincere appreciation at every opportunity. Make the other person feel important. Two, don't criticize, condemn, or complain. Three, make your cause bigger than your ego. Four, work for progress.
not perfection. 5, be solution conscious, not problem oriented. 6, invest time in the activity that brings the highest return on investment according to the priority list of responsibilities. Effort alone doesn't count. Results are the reasons for activity. 7, fulfilling responsibility is a good reason for work. Discipline is the method. 8, recognize and accept your own weaknesses. 9, make checklists and constantly refer to them. 10, always show the people in your life the humility of gratitude. Now let's look at 6 action steps for performance-oriented managers. 1, give regular, specific, and observable behavior feedback on performance. 2, respect the lines of communication and authority. 3, make timely decisions. 4, be accessible. 5, encourage creative ideas. And 6, provide personal support. There are 10 double win rules that lead to top team performance. Let's look at them. When dealing with others, 1, remember that a smile is the most powerful social tool we have at our disposal. 2, listening is the most neglected skill in business or home today. The person who listens controls the final outcome of the discussion. Encourage others to talk, and then consciously remove any barriers to your good listening skills. 3, talk in terms of the other person's interest. You will find a uniqueness and specialness in every individual you meet. Others are interested when discovered. Check out the other person's point of view. Ask questions you already know the answer to, and you will get to see the other person's perspective. Most ideas are more palatable if we discover them ourselves. People who truly care about others lead them down the discovery path. 5, what you are speaks so loudly I can't hear what you say. Remember to model the behavior and attitude you want the other person to have. 6, give assignments that allow you to express faith and confidence that the other person can successfully perform in the task assigned. 7, always make requests, never give orders. 8, develop your ability to use the narrative story and the meaningful analogy. These are powerful teaching tools. 9, always be respectful of others. Show your respect by being on time for meetings or letting others know why you must be late. 10, return phone calls and letters immediately. There is no excuse for not doing so. Now I'd like to explode some management myths. 1, manipulation and motivation are often the same thing. That's absolutely not true. Manipulation is getting people to act for you in ways that may not necessarily be for their own good. Motivation is helping people recognize mutual interest and getting them to join the cause because there is a benefit for them as well as you. 2, making your best effort is all that really counts. No, too many people substitute effort for accomplishment. The reason for working is to get results. The person who gets the most results with less effort is working smarter and harder. Fatigue is not an indicator of success. 3, delegation is the key to management success. Wrong again. Delegation is not telling someone what you want, when you want it, and how it is to be done. This is direction. Delegation means assigning the results you expect and designing a follow-up system that allows you to inspect what you expect. New employees get direction. Experienced employees get delegation. Determining which employees need direction, giving it to them, and delegating results and the authority to get those results is an important key to management success. 4, managers are normally superior physically, mentally, and spiritually. Nope, very few managers are normal. And there's nothing in the book that says a manager is a superior. Very simply put, managers are people willing to take responsibility and work through others to achieve results. As Fred Smith says, an executive is not a person who can do the work better than others. Rather, he is one who can get others to do the work better than he can. Are you trying to be a supervisor or a super worker? 5, managers must control all circumstances. No way. Managers deal with problems and situations, and there is a distinct difference between the two. A situation exists because you cannot control it. People get ulcers trying to control the uncontrollable. A problem is something you can take action on. Excellent managers learn the difference between the two. Take action on problems and stop worrying about situations. Now, here's your challenge. There really are no great revelations in this brief summation. However, professionals don't need to be told, but they're glad to be reminded. If you will listen to these few thoughts every day for 21 days, your career will be greatly enhanced by the principles you will be putting into action.
The Zig Ziglar Corporation offers a broad range of personal, family, and business development programs. If you would like a free full-color catalog, call area code 214-233-9191 or write the Zig Ziglar Corporation, 3330 Earhart, Carrollton, Texas, 75006. For a complete catalog of our TDM McGraw-Hill audio cassettes featuring the best in self-improvement, self-hypnosis, business management, motivation, and more, write to TDM McGraw-Hill, 560 South State College Boulevard, Fullerton, California, 92631, or call area code 714-441-0782. Thanks for listening.